In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, here's a word for you sports fans. This Friday night, the Cavalcade of Sports takes you right to ringside at Madison Square Garden in New York. There, you'll hear a blow-by-blow account of the week's best boxing match. Cesar Bryan versus Charlie Norcus in the 10-round main event. Don Dumphy, veteran prize fight reporter, brings you this on-the-spot account, and you'll hear all the tension and excitement that accompanies a Madison Square Garden main event. Hear Cavalcade of Sports this Friday night and every Friday. It's sports coverage at its best. Now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol.
What's going on in Washington?
Joe McCarthy's in a corner.
Crash goes another foreign policy.
Universal military training up again for the campaign.
What are the presidential prospects?
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight you'll hear Richard Harkness, Leif Eade, Earl Godwin, and Arthur Barrio. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. We bring you now Keys to the Capitol. And first, here's NBC correspondent Richard Harkness.
Well, gentlemen, I think that here in the Capitol this week, we're seeing a study of contrasts. You'll all recall, the country will too, certainly, the loosely run McCarthy investigation staged under Senator Munt. You recall how we joked, referred to Senator Carl Munt's moth-covered gavel. That was because Senator McCarthy really took over that hearing. He made those points of order. He made speeches. He even berated witnesses and even some of the committee senators. Now, however, this week we've seen here an entirely new type of inquiry by the Senate Committee under Senator Watkins, the Republican of Utah. That, of course, is the committee which is considering censor charges versus McCarthy. Now, Watkins, at the outset, announced rules of what he called courtroom decorum. However, we learned, and more to the point, Senator McCarthy learned, that the rules of procedure go beyond that. That Senator Watkins is following courtroom rules of evidence. He's throwing out the welter of immaterial charges and countercharges which muddied the record of the Munt investigating committee. Now, it appears to this one observer, and I'm speaking personally here, this technique by Senator Watkins has Senator McCarthy backed into a corner. McCarthy's very first move at the opening committee session was to challenge the fitness of Senator Johnson of Colorado to sit on the committee. Well, Watkins gaveled McCarthy down. The senator from Utah made one significant statement. He said, "We are not going to be subject to such diversions." And, equally significant, Senator McCarthy backed away. Well, then, just today, McCarthy moved to throw out one charge against him. Well, that was the charge that he was in contempt of a Senate committee which looked into his financial affairs back in 1952. The Watkins Committee tentatively rejected the McCarthy motion, so the senator from Wisconsin lost round two. Now, the interesting point will be, will Senator Watkins continue to keep Senator McCarthy in a corner? And the questions which follow from that, what will that mean in terms of Senator McCarthy personally? Well, gentlemen, everybody has an opinion or a point of view on Senator McCarthy. I'm sure that you all do, too.
Well, I think, Richard, speaking of whether he'll be able to continue to hold Senator McCarthy, I think he will. I also think he will, much to the delight of the Republican leadership on the Hill. I think that this will give them, if he continues to control McCarthy as he has been doing, will give the Republicans a chance to say next November, well, look, we can control these committees after all. Look at the superb job Mr. Watkins did, and be able to, as they like to say, point with pride.
Yes, of course, that is, it's a little unusual situation in that this is an especially and carefully chosen committee.
Yes, it is.
And is made up equally of Republicans and Democrats. So it's not quite the same as the normal committee of Congress.
Well, I think Senator Watkins has got a great deal at stake here in trying to hold Senator McCarthy, because Senator Watkins, of course, is not an Eisenhower Democrat. He's a Taft Republican, not an Eisenhower Republican, rather, or rather a Taft Republican, and he has a great deal, personally, it seems to me, at stake here. Not only as a nominee of the party, but as a person.
You mean Watkins?
Watkins has a great deal at
stake. Oh, he has.
Well, because if he is beaten down, say, by Joe McCarthy, knocked all around the Senate caucus room, he's going to lose an awful lot of face, personally.
Well, I don't want to argue this point, but it has confused me to think that the defendant, if you can call McCarthy defending the case, wants to find out whether one of the members of the six, the judges, has expressed an opinion publicly that showed his bias. And Watkins, supported by the whole committee, says you can't find out here. You'll have to find out privately or something of that sort. And it struck me as being very, very rigorous, almost to the point of unfairness, which I would not like to say in criticism of Watkins, because I think he probably knows what he's doing, but it does puzzle me. And I'll go this much further, that if Watkins or the committee is too severe, they may find that the sentiment of the Senate veers away from them a little.
Well, Earl, it was just today that Watkins sort of explained that. He said that it's impossible to bar a member of this committee from sitting because this committee is there solely to find the facts. That in the final analysis, it is the Senate itself which will pass judgment with a vote.
That is perfect.
And you could bar a man on the committee, but you couldn't bar him in the Senate anyhow from passing a final vote on the matter.
No, that's perfect. I wasn't thinking about barring him. I was thinking about the propriety, the legality, and the fairness of Watkins' position.
Well, it seems to me that Watkins' position was eminently legal.
Yeah, I think
so. He pointed out that the committee had no right to disbar any of its own members, that the full Senate had named these members to hear these charges relating to whether McCarthy should be censured, that the committee had no power over its own membership, and it would have to go back to the Senate.
That's right. You go back to the point that...
But that's an eminently legal position.
Yeah, you go back to the point that Watkins is running a legal courtroom type of investigation.
That's all
of us who covered the Mundt investigation recall very clearly how Senator McCarthy from day to day would criticize and make speeches and, as I said, berate some of the senators sitting on that committee. Dvorak, Scoop Jackson, he took them all on individually, and Watkins just serving notice he's not going to have any of that kind of business.
Well, I think that came out right in the first thing when Senator McCarthy was in on the little table out there in front of the witness stand, as we usually call it, and wanted to read his statement. The Chairman Watkins said, "Well, we've read your statement, and hurriedly, because it wasn't in here very long, we don't think it's relevant or material to the issues in this, but you can go ahead and read it anyway." He was just serving notice on him that he didn't have a right to read it. It was a courtesy of the court, almost.
Well, you read it, didn't you?
Yes, I read.
Remember, it seemed to me to be, for the first time since I've known Joe McCarthy, it was in minor key. It was down.
It was carefully edited.
That goes to my point, and I'm going to take it as confirmation that maybe Joe McCarthy is backed into a corner for the first time.
I think he showed it in
that particular statement of his, where he said, "This is a very serious thing for me," or words to that effect.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for your confirmation. I'm slightly surprised to have it.
My goodness, Mr. Harkins, I have never questioned any statement that you have ever made.
Well, you know, fellas, there's quite a question of foreign policy right now, and these days you can almost hear one after another of our foreign policies collapsing and crashing down. In the space of the last few weeks, Indochina is gone, and the EDC, the European Defense Community Treaty, which was counted on to be the strong, stout heart of the whole European defense system, NATO, that's been struck down, too. Now, those were two big ones, and you can hardly blame Secretary Dulles for being pretty bitter about France's knifing of EDC. Now he's off to Manila to try to build up some kind of bulwark in Southeast Asia, and that's not going to be any diplomatic picnic either. Because what have we got? We've got Britain and France. They're both European, not Asiatic powers. We've got Australia and New Zealand. They're Pacific, not Asiatic powers. We've got the Philippines, another Pacific power. On the mainland of Asia, where Asia's really got to be defended, we've got exactly one stout supporter, Thailand. We haven't got one of the big Asiatic powers with us. Not India, not Burma, not Indonesia. Pakistan's going to be represented at the Manila conference, but with firm advance notice that Pakistan won't necessarily be bound by anything, any plan that's drawn up at Manila. That doesn't leave us much to build on, because if Indochina proved anything at all, It proved that you can't defend peoples who won't get in there and help defend themselves. So Southeast Asia is still mighty soft for the building of any firm defense line. But of course, you've got to try. In diplomacy, the only time you give up is when the first shot is fired and the generals take over. And that's not yet by any considerable time. What do you think about this, Dick?
Well, Lisa Huber talking there, I was just thinking about John Foster Dulles more in personal terms. A good friend of his called on the secretary the other Saturday, a day when most of us are able to take a day off. The Secretary of State was in his study there in his home. His big desk was clear of papers. The secretary's guest happened to look on the floor, and over there was a pile of documents about a foot high, and over there was a pile of documents about 6 inches high, all over the floor of the study, little stacks of documents. And his friend said, "Good heavens, Foster, what's going on?" And the Secretary of State didn't laugh. He looked and pointed rather grimly. He says, "Well, that big stack there is Southeastern Asia. That stack is the European Defense Community." He just had these problems on the floor in front of him, and he was sitting there at his desk sort of looking at one pile and mulling over that problem and passing on to the next. Certainly, if a man or a country had problems in diplomacy these days, the man is John Foster Dulles, and the country is the United States.
Yeah, I agree with that, but we, you know, we set up a sort of a strong defense line and speeches, at least, on Indochina. Now Indochina's half gone, at least. It's gone, half of it, at least, is gone, and the other is still pretty soft because you can't tell what those South Vietnamese are going to do now that half their country is going over to the Reds.
I suppose this is oversimplification, Leaf, but the speeches under the Truman administration and then the speeches under the early days of the Eisenhower administration were all based on the fact that we were the world leader, that we would take the lead in holding back the communists on this side of the world, holding back the Reds on that side of the world. It seems to me that after Geneva, particularly, we've come around to the position, call it a new policy, a revised or modified policy, I don't know what it might be, that we're coming to the position that we can hold back communism only where we're taken in as partners. Now, we were ready to go into Indochina. I think that's a fact, go in there militarily. But we said we want to be asked in by the Asiatic powers that are involved. We want to go in as an equal partner with the French. The French and the Asiatic powers would not meet those terms, so we stayed out. We did not take the leadership of moving in. What do you think of that as sort of a really sharp revision of our policy?
I think that's exactly our position. It's a very realistic thing.
But
you cannot abdicate leadership. No. It's nothing that we chose. Well, that we can give up.
The president says we ought not to think of these things in terms of leadership, a guerrilla leadership, which puzzled some people, and it made George Meany of the AFL, addressing the Legion, I mention it again, saying that that was defeatism. Well, it seems to me that he probably means you can't rush in there like an advanced salesman or a missionary crowd. That just as Dick says, if the folks don't want it, there's no use of us trying to inoculate it into them. We're not trying to. We can't do it unless they
exactly,
want.
Exactly, Earl. But that still doesn't settle the problem.
No, it doesn't.
That's a statement of our position as of the moment. But it still does not solve our problem. You can't give up.
Do you think we can settle it?
Well, the president was saying in his news conference, laid it down as a sort of a firm military dictum that if Southeast Asia, Malaya went, the whole Pacific line of defense would be turned. That's not France or Britain he's talking about. That's us he's talking about.
I know.
And so our diplomacy has still got to keep trying.
Your desperation, we have to salvage what we can get.
It's not desperation. You've got to gather up the materials you've got and try to do something with them.
You talk about what materials there are. I think it might be pointed out that John Foster Dulles and this revision of American policy, I take it we're agreed it has been revised, behind him he had an administration or a Congress which cut taxes $7 billion this last session of Congress, and then made sharp cuts of upwards of around $5 billion, I believe, in our defense spending. Mr. Dulles just didn't have the materials behind him to carry out such declarations of massive retaliation and here's a line where we will stand and the communists don't cross it or going into Indochina. I think that should be pointed out when you talk about our State Department policy.
Well, of course, they didn't get domestic politics. They didn't brag about the cuts in defense spending and the cuts in taxes. But then, if it turns out sour in foreign policy,
you know perfectly well that those cuts don't commence to take effect in materiel for some time. We've got a mountain of money in back order.
That is perfectly true, but it's an indication to the world on which direction we're taking.
Certainly, and the psychological effect is great. Just a cut in defense spending.
Because the foreign offices will take due note of that.
Well, now, Phyllis, I'm going to talk about something which may have an effect on this military matter. The president told the Legion Convention, the American Legion Convention, that universal military training is a number one must for the next Congress, and if the president wants enough votes in Congress to put that all the way over, it might seem logical that he and the administration from end to end gets behind the subject in the congressional campaign, which is now almost upon us, and see to it that there's elected a Congress which at least will not block the program. You know, Congress never has gone all the way out on universal military training, but as a matter of little-known fact, the current draft law, the one they're drafting boys under now, selective service, we call it, is a universal military training law and has that in the title, but it does not work out to provide the effective and practical reserve of men that the president wants and which the American Legion has wanted and expressed itself to that end in many a resolution adopted at these conventions almost since the beginning. And as a matter of technical law writing, it would take only a few changes in the draft law now in the books to bring about the very thing the president has in mind. Something like this, and this is rather simplification, that there be established a reserve of trained men in definite units to which each man would be assigned after a brief period of training. There is a reserve now, but it is general in character. It is without form and void. It's just a mob. Nobody can be called back to any definite company, regiment, battery, or what have you. And it is true that men who have served their time in the armed forces are automatically in the reserve now, but as I say, there's nothing there but a vast, unorganized pool. What the armed services and the president are asking is a reserve which is simply a silent, yet perfectly organized army to spring into action at one order. Each man to go to his post, and when that particular mobilization is complete, the men will have a complete organization ready to march. The idea, too, is that every young American man should have the opportunity to serve. There would be exceptions, of course. Under the general head of manpower, men who have to work in the factories with a small group of technical and scientific workmen. But Congress generally balks. It balks from the start. I remember Woodrow Wilson, Democratic Party, balked at the idea of the first draft, and the fight for that was carried on in the House by a Republican, Representative Julius Kahn of California. Rural America was generally pacifist, didn't like the draft or anything else connected with the military. Right now, that feeling persists with varying degrees in various sections and among various groups, and unless I'm mistaken, President Eisenhower will not find a cohesive support for outright universal military training in either Armed Service Committee of the Senate and House where this sought-for law must originate. Now, you fellas think that's going to cause any trouble?
Yes.
Well, I was about to say, though, I think we've reached the point in the world situation where Congress can't go on forever balking. It's certainly a serious situation. When you think back, go back to 1941, those famous maneuvers we had with broomsticks for guns and jeeps for tanks. We used to have an army that you could put in Yankee Stadium. That's a national disgrace.
You speak feelingly about those.
I speak feelingly upon those maneuvers. I do think it's a national disgrace, and I think it doesn't do any young man any harm to serve a definite period of military training.
Particularly when they're all on the same level.
All on the same level. They all go in.
I'm going to stay out of this, if you don't mind. I happen to be in favor of universal military training for my three boys, and Mrs. Harkness is against it. So, gentlemen, would you just let me sit this one out?
Are you going to be man or mouse?
Anyhow.
Keep your mind.
Richard always it gives us a lot of wisdom in other matters.
I think it's interesting, however, that General Eisenhower has always been a great universal military training man. In the presidential campaign, he very conveniently forgot UMT, decided it was no time to bring it up while we were at war in Korea. Now, politically, I think maybe he believes that the atmosphere, the climate's changed, and It has a chance
there,
in Congress, and that the people will take it.
There, I think, is exactly the point. Whether the American political climate has changed enough to get this thing through, because Congress is not deciding on its own whether universal military training should be is a good thing or not. It's deciding on the terms of the next election, whether any large percentage of the voters will be outraged. And anything that outrages a large percentage or a sizable percentage even of voters is something that Congress stays away from.
Don't you think the American people are taking a much more realistic approach to this?
Maybe the majority does.
We hope so. I think that you're probably Mario, talking about something that I can describe in this way, I believe so. The year before the war, young men could enlist for a year's training, remember, and thus pay off their draft debt. And while in the midst of that, Congress wanted to drop everything connected with military that year and everything else. And President Roosevelt made a heavy demand that it be continued, the training of young men, selective service. I can remember I was in the gallery of the House of Representatives, and the thing was, it boiled over. It was the most dramatic afternoon. Sam Rayburn came down from the Speaker's chair and made a tremendous appeal for the continuation of this training. And it won, carried through the House by one vote.
And that was within days of Pearl Harbor.
And I'm going to say shortly thereafter, Pearl Harbor happened. And we may have another Pearl Harbor or something. Possibly the American people are closer to thinking that way.
Well, of course, there's also the economic as well as the political aspect of this. If we're going to maintain any large organized military force, either in standing or in reserve, you've got to find some way of doing it cheaper, of putting it on a service basis rather than on a pay basis. Now our draftees and volunteers are largely a paid army. They're not paid highly, but we try to bring them up somewhere near the standard of the civilian. It seems to me that you've got to put it on a service basis, something that is required of every young American if you're going to get this thing across.
Well, it's a tough nut for Congress to crack. There's no question about that. We'll just have to wait to see what they do about it. You know, what do you say we drag out a crystal ball?
All right.
You know, I think it's safe to say that 1 year from next July, if you want to make it sound fairly close at hand, or 2 years from last July, if you'd like to make it sound like the distant future, all four of us stand a fairly good chance of being in Chicago or New York or some other good-sized city attending political conventions. You remember the last one? Well, that being the case, I'd like to be one of the first to discuss possible Democratic and Republican nominees, principally because no one will remember 2 years from now what I say today, or so I hope.
What we say here today will be a little remembered.
So as long as we're giving the crystal ball a little workout, let's begin with the prediction that, barring all-out war, President Eisenhower will not run for re-election. The president has given every indication during these past 2 months of having a sort of change of heart about the White House. His spirit improved once Congress began to move ahead with a good part of his legislative program. He's demonstrated definite assurance at recent news conferences. Yet his utterances while vacationing in Denver seem to show he still considers the presidency confining, a great conflict there with his private life, and Washington a city of distraction which contributes nothing to concentration. He freely admits there's no comparison between Denver and the Capitol, yet greatly outweighing any of these factors is this. He and Mrs. Eisenhower have had no home life as such in all of their married life. They've been transferred from one army post to another, always occupying quarters. The president has seen duty in Mexico and overseas in 2 world wars. And now he and Mrs. Eisenhower have eyes only for that farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I think they want to settle down away from the pressures and the tensions of either the military or politics. And one can't discount either the fact the president's age is also a factor, one which would seem to indicate he would be reluctant to accept another term. Where does this leave the Republicans? They have Vice President Nixon, a young man in whom the president seems to have great confidence, but also a young man who seems in need of smoothing the political sailing in his home state of California before taking on a national battle. We hear some Republicans talk of Governor Stratton of Illinois. He's from a Midwest state and a big one at that. Which reminds me that, speaking of Republican governors, we can't overlook Dan Thornton of Colorado, who was such a loyal Eisenhower supporter. The last few conventions have taken up the name of our present Chief Justice, Governor Earl Warren of California. Perhaps he would not be at all unwilling to step off the bench. Add another name, Mr. Harold Stassen, who has never been inclined to repeat Mr. Coolidge's famous, "I do not choose to run." And then there is always a gentleman, current address, Governor's Mansion, Albany, New York, man by the name of Dewey. But how about the other side? I think that regardless of where we attend this next convention, we're going to see delegates waving coonskin caps. Senator Keefe's whomping victory over Pat Sutton in Tennessee will do him no harm. There are Democrats who are thinking of a young man, one who might add a dash of glamour, so they discuss Governor Minor of New Jersey, even to the point of trying to link him with Miss Margaret Truman. Well, Georgia Senator Dick Russell certainly has lost no prestige since the last Democratic convention. But when a former Illinois governor, as we mentioned before, a man named Adlai Stevenson, sent to Premier Mendes France a letter urging France to pass EDC, he proved that as far as he's concerned, he's the head of the Democratic Party, perhaps none unwilling to engage again in whistle stops and flying hops. And if Mr. Truman gives Mr. Stevenson his blessing, that could be it. Do you gentlemen care to add any entries?
Well, I don't know. It seems to me, Arthur, that somewhere in there you've got the candidate.
Somewhere in there, not even enough of them.
Well, that's
I don't know, but it seems to me that the reasoning about President Eisenhower is a little tenuous. He does find the White House very confining, and every once in a while he's just got to get out. That's all there is to it. He just has to get out. He's got to go to Georgia or go to Denver or go someplace to get out.
Yeah, but you know,
there's something, that old bug, when the time comes to leave, you know, there's been many a guy who made up his mind to just do this much and stayed on. And I think that's what's good.
Well, if the Republicans win this next Congress, and of course there's a large question about that, why, the gang will get behind and push Mr. Eisenhower right over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, or if the Republicans lose this next Congress, they'll say you've got to run for vindication and to carry on the Republican program.
Things of that sort. I got one little name here to mention as a possibility of something. Not
your candidate?
And that's Charlie Halleck of Indiana, who certainly is coming up good as a leader in the House. I suppose you'll see him promoted as a vice presidential candidate.
He has been a vice presidential candidate for some time.
Well, again, I think he'll come through.
In the
list of possibilities, you know, we're 2 years from now, nobody's going to remember this. Senator Symington of Missouri seems to has a lot of friendly following. Bob Kerr, I think, is always a candidate from Oklahoma. Is he not, Mr. Harkness?
Yes, I think he is.
It's a cinch. We aren't going to elect a president today, however. But I did have this thought that I don't think we should wind up this show without mentioning another big story in town this week, and that's the American Legion Convention. Now, Earl, you're a past commander of a local post. It seems to me that the Legionnaires are becoming more and more sedate, more and more conservative. How do you feel about that?
Out of 150,000, I only saw one that had a tickler on the street trying to tickle the girls. And the cops all here tell me that all the arrests for rowdyism and drunkenness are from our local villages, Washingtonians, very few Legionnaires. They brought their wives and children, and I think they're getting a little old. They're like David, you know, in his old age.
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News, as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you have heard Arthur Berrio, Earl Godwin, Lee Feed, and Richard Harkness. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at the same time each week.